Thanks so much to Manifold for being this week's sponsor of Does Not Compute. Listen, we're all developers here, and we know that managed cloud services can help save you time and effort. It doesn't make sense to build your own logging platform, CMS, or authentication service when there already exists a managed tool or API to solve the problem for you. But there's just so many out there. How do you find the right services to integrate with your application? How do you stitch them together? And how do you manage access to them and access credentials between multiple projects and multiple teams? Managing all those things alone is a full-time job. Manifold makes your life easier. It provides a single workflow to organize your services, connect your integrations together, and then share them with your team. You can discover the best services for your projects in the Manifold Marketplace, or bring your own custom integrations, and manage them all under one dashboard. They have services covering authentication, messaging, monitoring, content management, and more. Manifold keeps you on the cutting edge, so you can focus on building your project rather than focusing on problems that have already been solved. And once you have the services you need, you can deliver your configuration to any environment and deploy on any cloud. Manifold is completely free to use. And if you head on over to manifold.co/DNC, you get a coupon code for $10, which you can use to try out any service on the Manifold Marketplace.
It feels like I'm still working, but I'm not still working.
You're here now. Stop working.
Okay, well, I was doing two things. I was doing one thing and I was almost done, and then I got interrupted and I had to do another thing. And I didn't finish either, so.
Well, now you're doing a third thing and we better finish this one. Sean, you're so far away.
I'm about to be a lot farther in less than a week, so.
Yeah, I'm glad we finally, I'm not glad you're moving away, but I'm glad that you're moving away spurned us to action to actually meet up in person.
Oh, yeah. So I told a couple of people that we were meeting in person and they're like, you haven't yet? Like, you're just now getting to it? We just now got to it over the weekend. It was good. The food was, we went out and had some dinner, and you didn't bring Bucky, cat of the show Bucky.
No.
Which I was a little sad about, but you probably would have froze to death in the car. So I'm glad, I guess, you didn't bring Bucky.
You would have complained the whole time. Yeah. No, it was really good. It was awesome meeting you and Jamie and have a nice fancy dinner. It was a little fancier than I was expecting. Sorry about that.
It's all good. I'm glad that we could come to a solution to our debate about the effectiveness of using a hot air balloon to survive an earthquake.
I wouldn't say we came to a
I think
consensus.
We came to a consensus. No. We definitely did. I ran it by Paul too, and he was like, yeah, it makes, you know, I'm not sure how scalable it is, but it's plausible, certainly plausible, which is good enough for me.
So your theory was that in the event of an earthquake, that a hot air balloon is a safe refuge until the earthquake passes, right?
Yeah. So here, I'm just imagining myself. I'm hanging out.
Tethered, I assume.
Right. I'm hanging out. I got a tarp in my backyard with a hot air balloon underneath, right? For just a such occasion.
Sure. This is strictly in preparation for moving to California, because this is a
yeah
necessary. This is like a way of life out there.
Right. It is. And so I'm hanging out. I'm in the backyard gardening or whatever. I'm tending to my spinach patches, and my Apple Watch vibrates and says, hey, dummy, there's a tsunami coming, or an earthquake is coming, or something. So what I do is I run over to my tarp. I inflate the balloon that is tethered to something. I don't know what it's tethered. Maybe it doesn't even have to be tethered to anything. I inflate the balloon. Everyone hops in and we just go up for a little bit.
Flawless plan.
I mean, I don't see what would go wrong. What could go wrong with that? Right? If the tsunami is like 30 feet high, you just go 40 feet high or 50. Well, I guess the wind, you'd probably want to go higher than that, but you could just go up.
Yeah. It's more of a question of, yeah, scalability. And
I just don't see what could go wrong with that. Yeah. So like it was, let's say we are tethered. I think this scenario came up. We're tethered up there for a while and some marauders want to climb up the rope or the chain that we're using to tether. Well, I just bring a couple watermelons to defend myself, maybe some rocks, something, you know.
You got to coat the watermelons in oil so you can hurl flaming watermelons down at them.
Maybe I just keep a broom in the basket, and so I can just push them off of the rope with the broom. That seems like something that I could do. But I don't see...
I think you need to think about this a little more.
Well, what else would I do?
Just saying.
Treehouse, fall down. Helicopter, I don't have enough money.
Open field, laying prone.
The earth could swallow you up at any time, and
if you're
just laying in open field. So
it almost happened in Alaska.
It did. So I just don't see, short of other flying objects, planes, what was the example we used? An albatross, maybe? Like an albatross coming through? Those are pretty big. And it's not, you know, I saw an albatross 2 hours from San Francisco on into the ocean. So, I mean, they're like relatively close in terms of them flying to Australia from Australia to the Farallon Islands. Getting to Santa Cruz from there isn't that much of a stretch if you consider the distance and mileage.
Yeah, but they're pretty defensive creatures, right? Like, I wouldn't want to fight an albatross.
I didn't go near enough. It was just kind of flying around, and the guy was like, "That's an albatross." And I was like, "Hey, that's cool. I saw one in The Rescuers Down Under a couple of times."
Do they train you in jiu-jitsu for albatross defense?
Albatross defense. What would I do? I'd just cover my eyes. I don't know.
I mean, they have kind of like long necks. You could just like put in a chokehold or something.
Well, I probably could do that, but I don't know if it's illegal or not. I don't think they're endangered, right? Jamie's not here to tell me if I can defend myself against an albatross.
I'll leave that homework for you.
Certainly a whale. There was. She was telling me about a 911 call she read about in the news where someone was on a boat and a whale got too close to their boat, so they called 911. They called the police, and Jamie was like, "Well, you know, they're technically breaking the law by being that close to the whale and disturbing it." So the person calling 911 is basically just turning themselves in for being too close to it.
That's rough.
Yep. So hot air balloons. I'd love to hear some feedback on that. And maybe it's my new startup is a hot air balloon company geared towards the apocalypse.
I like it.
Yeah.
Get some CO2 canisters. Those are pretty cheap to rent. You know, kind of an emergency inflate.
Yeah.
Although I think, that wouldn't work. CO2 is probably heavier than air. Maybe just really warm CO2.
Yeah. Helium. I don't know. Some helium canisters. We need a fast expand, I suppose, right? That's what we need.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or just leave the balloon up there and just have a rope or, you know, like a ladder, rope ladder. You just climb right up like a treehouse that doesn't have a tree.
Yeah, I could do that. I feel like someone might see that and just invite themselves on in.
Well, then you make it a UAV balloon. It hovers and you can control it remotely. We'll talk. We'll get some funding.
We'll have to figure that out.
Series C funding.
Yeah.
I don't know how VCs work.
We'll have to figure that out for sure.
Anyway, on to things that we actually know about.
Well, I know a whole lot about hot air balloons, so I don't want to misguide people there. To let them think that I don't know about hot air balloons because I've been in one once.
It's more times than I've been in one. So
yeah,
you are the professional, the expert here.
Yes. So what have you been working on this week?
Oh man, let's see. What have I been working on? I've been working plugging away at my Nuxt application here. We had a little bug, which I'm going to save this for a discussion later because it kind of ties in to what I think we want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just plugging away, knocking things off the list there, trying to use it more and more and get a feel for how these little like weird edge cases and things that, okay, now we've got the main core functionality of our client-side application working. Where are the rough edges? You know, what are the kind of still some like performance things to work out? There's still some weird bugs that are tricky to track down, things involving state and you know, just that kind of odds and ends here and there. And the more you find, the more you look for, the more you find.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of why we're going through those motions now and just playing with it and basically being our own beta testers, dog fooding it.
Right. Yeah.
And it's been pretty positive. We've dug up a lot of stuff and fixing a lot of stuff so far. Nothing, no showstoppers yet. Still just plugging away.
How does maintenance feel compared to what you had before?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's, well, with jQuery, with the old application, it was literally a single file jQuery blob.
Mm-hmm.
And so you knew where to look for everything. It was in there somewhere. But with Vue, there's kind of, because it's more decoupled, it actually kind of necessarily makes it a little more difficult to debug in the sense that, you know, a mouse click isn't just like a mouse click, right? It's an event that could be wired up to another component, that could emit an action, that could be async, that could commit a mutation to the state. There's WebSockets involved, so it's like the state of the server versus the state of the client, which we had before, but now it's a little more concrete and like, this is the shape of the state, this is where we store it. And so it's, for obscure, like deep, inconsistent, hard to reproduce bugs, it's actually kind of challenging because there are so many pieces. But, and in general, when you find something, it's like a one-line fix or like, oh, I did something stupid, right? It's not like there's some overarching architectural problem.
I think that's mostly the case for us at DK as well with our app. It's mostly a lot of the hotfixes that come in are pretty simple things where it's typo is not the right word or like syntax error. It's not really like a syntax error. It's just kind of like an omission of something is usually what happens.
Yeah. And I always find, I don't remember if I mentioned this on here before, but there's this inverse law of git commits where the number of lines you change in the commit is inversely proportional to how long the commit message is. So for example, right, you spend half a day tracking down a bug and it's a one line fix because it's something stupid like mm-hmm. a typo or an assignment when you were looking for equality check, right? Like something stupid. Or, well, those are bad examples. Really, it's more the small changes that ripple through the application and affects things X, Y, and Z. So you have to walk back your whole train of thought, that whole half a day you spent debugging this thing, you have to condense it down and explain, oh, we had to fix this because of this, because of this, because of this, right? That's mm-hmm. And then when you check in a huge feature, you're just like, implemented feature. Could be, you know, 20 files.
Yeah, I mean, you're right about all of that. That tends to be what happens. I try really hard not to just commit a big chunk of things. And I've been pretty good about it lately. I've been trying to use, when I mostly use IntelliJ, and they have pretty solid VCS support inside of that. So that helps me kind of commit incrementally on feature branches and things like that. VS Code has a pretty decent job as well. But I find if I don't get into the habit of using whatever editor or IDE that I'm using, if I'm not using the VS tools that are kind of supplied by it, that's when I sort of forget about it and just kind of commit things in larger chunks. I also try to commit as I go, I guess, like, cause I bite myself a lot when I make a ton of changes and then I want to walk something back. I'm like, oh, I didn't commit and undo isn't working or undo doesn't have what I need, you know? So I've been trying to make a more conscious effort to commit incrementally. But I think with all of that said, I think generally what you describe, I think is hilarious because it's mostly true.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, it's definitely easier to work with in general. Maybe for some classes of bugs, a larger view application can be a little tricky, but there's a lot of pieces to know about. Mm-hmm. But I mean, again, like I talked about last week, adding new features is just awesome. You know, refactoring things is pretty straightforward. You know, breaking things down into components.
Yeah,
it's pretty much what's written on the tin. That's what I found.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, and I have a good idea about what the answer is, but I want to hear what you have to say about it anyway, and then you can ask me the same question, I suppose. But so you mentioned like there's a whole kind of like moving to this more reactive style of programming where we're using Vue and Vue handles kind of like the data layer and stuff like that. I assume you didn't have any sort of testing for your jQuery, and I assume that you probably don't have any test library set up for Vue. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that like most bugs or most hotfixes that you have to deploy end up being like, it's not anything complicated. It's kind of like I forgot this or I forgot about that. It's usually like forgetting about small details, or it's usually something very small and the hotfix is a one-liner. And that's been my experience as well in like I've been using Nuxt for like 2 years now, I think. It's certainly been the case for me. And my follow-up to that question was, oh my, Siri, stop. Nobody asked Siri about McDonald's. You all heard me. I didn't say anything. Anyway, that's our first Alexa or Siri stop on the podcast.
I really want McDonald's now.
Okay, so with that said, I guess I was just going to ask you, like, do you have any plans? Have you even thought about like testing Vue components at all?
No, I haven't. I don't even know the names of libraries or frameworks that are out there for doing that, or how I'd even go about that.
That's fine.
I had some experience with sagas on React, and I hated every minute of it. And it was just one too many layers of abstraction for me to like wrap my head around, especially the way JavaScript, like the way sagas hook into JavaScript language features, like generate function generators and yield, async await, that kind of stuff. It's like, it was very, very, very indirect. Everything you had to do was very indirect. And the reason you did it was because it, one of the reasons you can do it is because of it improves testability, because sagas give you this way to hook into, you know, everything the application does and provide, you know, fake data or mock data or whatever you want to do to test your application. It makes those components testable. And that was just one way to do that. And I, the benefit that that was going to bring was not worth the mental overhead for me. So I had to ditch it. And I know, like, someone brought sagas to Elixir. I haven't looked at it yet. I don't know why you would do it. I'm sure there's a reason.
So what, I mean, I don't even know. I've heard the name, obviously, or not obviously. That's, I shouldn't say it like that. I've heard the name of Saga. I've heard React Sagas before. I don't know anything about them.
You have to really look it up to understand it. It's been a while since I've touched it.
No worries. I'm looking at it right now, and it is kind of, it's interesting.
It's a way to take, like, small little chunks of logic and kind of string them together in a way that is pretty human readable, in the sense that, like, you break everything down to these little individual steps and then you kind of compose them together. Doing a bad job explaining it, but we'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, I will put a link in the show notes. That's interesting. I mean, you talk to a lot of front-end devs, and it, I think more often than not, you would find people that say, like, I don't necessarily have a need to write unit tests for my front end or whatever. And I think certainly for you, you're having a much easier time maintaining the update, going from jQuery to Vue, because of, you know, everything we've talked about before. Especially, like, you're kind of eliminating an entire class of bug because Vue handles that and Vue's already tested, right? So you just kind of let Vue do its thing. And I have been mostly that way too. And I think Design Collective's code base, or front end code base specifically, is maybe the only front end code base that I've ever written any tests for. And even then, it's not a whole lot. And the tests that I've written have been to cover bugs for things that just can't have bugs in them.
Such as?
For example, we have currency inputs. So they're just masked inputs. So when you're typing in, like, say you're adding products, and you want to type in a price, you get a nice, like, dollar formatted string in the input for you. And it looks nice. It's representative of what you would assume, or what you would equate a value for a product to. On the API side, we store everything in cents.
Right.
So our component basically handles masking in the input and then doing the conversion from dollars to cents. So that way, when you save the record, the API gets cents. And the input masking, we're using Vue text mask, and I think that's just a wrapper for a text mask library. I'll put that in the show notes as well. But yeah, so I've created a couple of small bugs just with that, and so that's just something that, like, you really, really don't want someone adding a product and the price not being what they thought it was being set to. Like, say that it's supposed to be $3,000 and it's set to $30 or something. That'd be real bad, right?
Yeah, you better get that right.
Exactly. So it's not hard to get that right. It's just one of those things where if it's not right, you should know, like, you should just immediately know. And so we really don't have that many tests. I'm using Jest as my test runner, and I'm using the Vue Test Utils library that pretty much walk you through how to write how to do everything in terms of, like, testing Vue components. It's pretty good, and it looks a lot more straightforward than Sagas, I think, at first blush. And I'm going to send you a screenshot right here. These are some of the unit tests for the currency input, as an example. I'll put this in the show notes as well. And it's nothing complicated. It's pretty, like, pretty just straightforward stuff.
Yeah, this looks cool.
Yeah. So that was really all I wanted to ask about was, like, have you thought about it? Have you looked into testing Vue at all? And if you hadn't, there's Vue Test Utils, which are first party, and it works great with Jest. And it's nice if there are edge cases that kind of might take a second to track down and reproduce, it might be worth a look at Test Utils and Jest to get those set up.
It would be difficult. I'm not trying to make excuses for why I don't test things, but it sure would be difficult to do because of all the state. The way the application works is the entire state of everything you're looking at is actually determined by, like, in real time by a, you know, server somewhere, right? There's almost no state that's local that you change directly. Like whenever you click a button, it like fires off an event to go change a radio somewhere, and then eventually that thing asynchronously comes back with an updated state that you, then you commit locally. So it's like, again, testing the whole application, testing individual components, you might be able to sort of isolate them and be like, oh, I can't even think of a good example. Like I'm looking at it now, and it's like, what would you even test in isolation that would give you value? I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I guess I'd have to try it and see. You know,
that's a good point, and that's really probably the biggest reason that I haven't really messed with testing you like my UI or testing my front end, is because to me it always felt like a house of cards almost. Like everything has to be just so. In order for this thing to work, right? So all the data that you need has to be coming from the API, which theoretically is tested. And so it's kind of like you have to set up these single reproduction cases where maybe the data wouldn't even get to that point. Does what I'm saying make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I actually, this is a good segue. I can talk about this bug that I just had and why I wouldn't have caught it with the test. So we're having this issue where, When the console loads, sometimes basically it authenticates and then it sends your user information off to all the individual, you know, 20 or so ham radio sites. And those ham radio sites are like, oh, I've got a new user, their ID, whatever, the session ID. And then it's each site spits back a bunch of initialization stuff to that user and says what state it's in, what components that site has, so on and so forth, right? And I was having this bug and it was intermittent, which is frustrating, but also, you know, immediately screams, this is a race condition somewhere. And so what would happen would the site would load, but only like half the stations would appear. The other half would just show up as like unavailable, which they're there. And when you refresh it, a totally different set of stations would appear in a totally different set, just seemingly random. And what I immediately basically tracked it down to was that when you authenticate, because everything is so asynchronous, all the messaging, all the pub sub, all the distributed messaging in on the server side Elixir is async, the authentication message was actually too slow to come back. So like the sites would start spewing data at you before you even knew that you were logged in, right? because of just the way the servers were behaving with the message routing and the timing. It was just on the hairy edge. And that was a problem because, you know, that's a real interface issue that just relies on a server-side thing. So the fix actually ended up just being, you know, entirely in Phoenix. I had to basically ensure that the user gets the auth message before anything else, right?
Right.
And the way I do that is basically I just keep track of it. And if, for example, some messages come into that user and you're not authorized yet, it keeps like a backlog, just starts throwing them on a list on that state until the authentication comes through, and then it blasts the rest of the messages through. yeah, it's really hacky, but like I was like, okay, the real problem is that these things are happening asynchronously and shouldn't be. But like I don't want to go down the route of trying to make things synchronous, because then you lose all the advantages of the Beam and Elixir and PubSub and everything, right? You start serializing everything and suddenly you get single thread performance, and that's not a great, you know, that's a bottleneck.
Right.
So I thought I'd just fix it for this edge case for now, and that way I can keep the other async features of the system without having to touch them. And it actually seems to work fine now. So fingers crossed, we got to test it, obviously, because it's inconsistent, but I'm pretty sure it's good now. So yeah, that's it's tricky when you're developing these things and they're so tightly integrated to even figure out where the problem even is.
Right. Yeah. Because mostly what I've done is actually just test kind of like display components. I haven't really tested any like piping between stuff, I guess. I don't know how else to describe it. Right. So you kind of like that situation there, actually, what you're seeing was half of the stations loading in. Right. But testing, you know, writing tests to just make sure that things display properly wouldn't cover that case. This is a deeper issue.
Right, correct.
Yeah.
Which I suppose I could have written a test that said like, oh, hey, if these messages come in out of order or not in an order I expect, maybe I could handle it better. Maybe I could be like, hey, you know, throw up a warning to the user or refresh the page or try to reorder the messages myself, like on the client side, right? Mm-hmm. There's some things you could do there to catch it and fix it maybe.
Yeah, but that's not even really like a real, that's more like a, it feels more like a stopgap, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough because most of the tests that I've written for Design Collective are simply just, hey, let's change this data and assert that some other piece of data is formatted correctly, mm-hmm. or similar, or you know, very similar. I haven't really ventured out beyond that too much, but really, like,
no, I think those things lend themselves very well to that, and it's worth it, and you've got, you know, some also that I don't think you don't have to test everything to be testing things, right? If you, like you said, you just got a few components in there.
Sure. Yeah. So really what I've been trying to do is, like, for the back end, I'm trying to do TDD as much as I can. And that's just something that I've been trying to do. And if a bug comes in, a hotfix has to go out, I make sure that at least one more test is written for that.
Sure.
So I don't ship any hotfixes without writing more tests. So the majority of the hotfixes that go for the client, like we mentioned, were just kind of one-liners or just really simple things that I don't know it would be necessary to write a test for that. And I say that now, and I can hear myself saying that for like an API, but it feels different, but maybe it's not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's weird. You draw this distinction in your head, like the front end isn't as important or something. Like you feel guilty, like, oh, it's just going to get neglected. But
right, yeah.
But the front end is something you're testing, like you click test things.
Yeah.
So, but that's not reproducible. It's not documented. It's not, you know, all the advantages that tests give you, you lose out on there.
Yeah, I mean, there's other stuff. Like you know, Paul and I have looked at using, I can never remember what it's called now. Like, you know, you're just using PhantomJS to drive, just like a Chrome driver or a web engine to drive your site for you and click on stuff. And I've thought about, if I'm having to click test a flow quite a bit repeatedly, I thought about using some plugin to record my actions and then replay them. And then I think, like, okay, well, if I'm doing that, I might as well just like put that in a file so I can run it other times, right? And then I think, like, well, if I'm doing that, then I should probably maybe like smoke test or like accept, you know, like run acceptance test on other pages. And then I get an email or someone messages me, and then it's all out of my head. Like it's just gone out the window, right? And it never happens. But I don't know. These are things that I've been thinking a lot about this week. Now, Paul and I, like, we've really been trying to focus more on click testing more. And a few months back, we did that ElixirConf episode where one of the videos I highlighted was about how you can't just rely on strictly unit tests or strictly acceptance tests. You have to have like a balance for things to be stable, or quote unquote stable. And click testing is a big part of that. And that's something that I often am quick to brush under. So I'll make a big change and I'll click through it twice. I'm like, yeah, it seems good. But the twice like click through wasn't nearly as adequate. It's not nearly as thorough as it probably should be.
You know what you really need to do, Sean? Just deploy things to production and let your users test it for you. They're free. Oh. Their time is free. Well, they'll give you dubious feedback.
Very dubious feedback. In fact, more often than not, I feel like they throw you off the scent.
It's probably true.
Than anything. So it's not good for my blood pressure either, I don't think. I haven't taken my blood pressure, but it's not good for that either. But I don't, yeah, that's just all been stuff I've been thinking about. So we've been like fixing some small bugs here and there, like the past couple of weeks up through the end of the year. We're not doing any new features. It's not really like a code freeze or a feature freeze. It's just, we're focusing on what was a Trello log, what is now something else log, which I'll talk about some other point in the future.
Oh man, you were so deep in the Trello. Now you're switching tools on me again?
Well, we're switching tools in the interest of consolidating things for our other people. It's less nice for Paul and I, but it's manageable, it's serviceable for us. And if everything is in one place for them, then that's more what I care about.
You change project management tools more than you change editors, so.
Well, as soon as we find one that people actually use, we'll stop changing project management tools.
Okay. Good luck.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. Mandates from above. But yeah, just makes me laugh. I'm in a good mood right now. I'm not so much stressed out about it anymore. But we've been working on just small things. And so what was funny was I messaged you about Elixir's task.start and task.async stream and streams and doing things outside of the request lifecycle. Mm-hmm. And you were like, well, funny you say that, because I just had a very similar thing that I'm fixing right now.
Yeah, I was thinking more about the async part of it, the async nature of the bug. But actually, now that I think about it, it's not totally applicable. You know, I mean, it kind of is, because the whole point of doing async is not to block things, right?
Right. So when I say that, it's a little bit different. So I haven't actually fully explained to you what we've been doing.
No, yeah.
Yeah, so you're in the dark, and I think you're gonna get a kick out of this. But
all right,
Okay. So we have various things, operations that need to happen. So let's say you're a store owner, and you want to cancel your plan. There's things that need to happen. So like, your store probably shouldn't be visible to the public anymore. Your product shouldn't be visible to the public anymore. And now, since we use Elasticsearch, we have to, you know, we have to tick some columns in the database, but then we also have to re-index a bunch of things. And that obviously should not happen in the lifecycle request. So if you were to cancel your store and you had 500 products and you clicked cancel, you shouldn't sit there and wait while all the operations are queued, right?
That's just like a big middle finger. Like, hold on, we're deleting your files.
You can't
please
leave.
Please wait.
You can't
please
leave.
Wait.
Timeouts galore, right? So that's just, you know, not a great experience. They think like, am I going to keep getting... It's just not a good experience for customers.
It's not really how the web is supposed to work either, right? Like, requests. People expect requests, pages to load quickly, requests to happen quickly. Sure.
Yeah. And so a few times in my naivete in the past, I've done things like, we have another endpoint, for example, for importing different sets of data. And so I'll think to myself, yeah, I'll just like throw these into jobs. And that's fine. And it works in testing, and it works usually in click testing. But then when you get into production and someone has a massive set and it takes longer than the default timeout for a request to actually enqueue all the jobs to import the data, then you're like, oh, I've made a mistake.
Okay.
Right. And so that's kind of where...
It's not doing the job. It's just queuing the job.
It's just queuing the job. Yes. There's just a lot of jobs to queue. Okay.
Okay.
And
you need a job for queuing your jobs.
Right. And so again, we use Redis because we're on Heroku. Like, normally we could use Ets or something similar that Elixir OTP ship with, but we're using Redis because we're on Heroku, and Heroku can restart our dynos whenever they please. And so what that was one thing that was happening was we basically queue a job into Redis for importing things, and that was taking longer than the default request duration or the timeout duration. And so that would obviously err, and the customer would be confused, and that's not great. So a simple solution for that is to just use test.start, and then you use test.start to actually do the enqueuing. And so that way it removes it from that request cycle, and the user clicks a button and they're like, hey, it worked, cool. And then after that, you know, after the request completes, then the machine does whatever it needs.
Right. And the important distinction for task.start versus task.async is task.start returns immediately and doesn't expect you to await on the result, right? It just spins off a task, which is just another process. It returns okay, and it uses no way for you to directly get the result of that task.
Yeah. So I mean, at this point, it's basically just like, yeah, hey, we got your data, we're gonna start importing it. And we do things like, we process it, like we don't import duplicates, and there's things like that. So there's a message that says accordingly, like everything that, you know, everything that's valid will be imported, and we won't import duplicates, etc. It's just kind of like a Dropbox for someone here, like, here's my data and I want you to do this with it, and we'll be like, cool, we're gonna do that with it, see you later. That's kind of like the transaction that happens, right? And the machine does the processing when it has the time to do it, and it works great. So that was like a relatively simple example, right? Like, you can just use task.start to do something outside of the request cycle, and you're not blocking things, and all good there. So let's go a little bit farther. And since we're using Elasticsearch, I can't remember the actual name. I think it's literally just Elasticsearch is the client for Elixir. I think it's just Elasticsearch Elixir, or Elixir Elasticsearch, or something like that. Anyway, it doesn't support the bulk reindexing endpoint yet for Elasticsearch, and that's cool. So let's say you have 1,000 products in your store, and we need to update the index. We should really just make one request to the index there. That'd be the most ideal thing to do, right? And since the library doesn't support that feature yet, we have to actually just we'd have to re-index 1,000 records in Elasticsearch for each one of your products.
Okay.
So now let's say that we've wrapped that, all that stuff is in test.start, so it doesn't happen in the request cycle. But to throw another log onto the fire, I think we're using Bonsai. I think it's called Bonsai in Heroku. They don't support concurrent indexing. And so what we did first was, okay, well, since this is in task.start, we're good. Like, it's not going to hold up the user. Everything's fine. We can just re-index the products there. Again, we hit an error and it's like, oh, Bonsai doesn't support concurrent re-indexes. So we're like, okay, shoot, how do we do this? And
when you say concurrent, you mean two different requests trying to reindex at the same time, or
yes,
sequentially? Like,
no, sequentially. Like,
what
works.
Does concurrent mean?
Concurrent means literally firing two products at the index at the same time.
Got it. Okay.
So Elasticsearch has support for this. It's just that our service provider doesn't.
Okay.
Unless we want to pay a lot of more money, I'd have to look at it again. But I just remember they were like, "Hey, you can't do that." And so a simple solution to that was use task.async string max concurrency one.
I mean, at that point, if you're just doing async stream task or with concurrency one, then you don't have a async stream. You just have a stream.
Yes, you just have a stream.
Yeah, there's no point. But you can still use a stream for that.
Yes.
Process. So is that what you're doing? Is that what you've been working on?
Yeah, that's what we're working on. We're just, yeah, so I mean, so it's kind of weird to test for this. The real fix for this is just to PR the library, the Elasticsearch library, which we have an item on our list to do that. We just haven't had the time to do that yet, because that's really truly the fix for that, because that's the right way to do it, is just submit a single request to reindex that data. That's the most performant way to do it. So these are kind of like stopgap solutions right now that we have to implement. And it's been kind of, I don't want to say annoying, but just like, it's kind of like you're propping things up and you're like, all right, I'll be back later, right?
Yeah, for yourself though.
Yeah, for myself, yeah. But yeah, so it's funny because you mentioned you're fixing a bug, and I've had to fix a couple of things where like accidentally, I think one was accidentally calling enum downstream from a stream. So when you call any of the enum functions, it's going to convert the stream back into a buffer.
Right.
It's going to stop the asynchronous nature of it. And then it'll block, if you do that in the request, it's going to block the request, you know? So it's just kind of like, oh yeah, duh. It's kind of like on the same level of fixing a small view bug. We're like, oh, that was stupid. You know, it's a similar thing. We're like, oh yeah, of course that'll block the request. Hotfix, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's funny because back in the day when I made the transition from Visual Basic 6 to VB.NET, that was when .NET 1.0 came out, there was no way. So in VB6, like the way you opened a file was like file.open, and it returned an integer, which was like a file descriptor. And then you just pass that integer around for reading, you know, reading and writing to files. And then you just closed it when you were done. But when suddenly .NET comes along and like there's streams everywhere. There's like a base io.stream class, like a sealed, what's the word? A class that has to be inherited from. Sealed is not the right word. Virtual class, thank you. It's been a while since I've been in that world. And then there were like a billion kinds of streams. There's file streams, there's string streams. There's, you can get streams from like web requests and stuff like that. And everything was a stream. And it was just so frustrating from a newbie developer who doesn't understand why I have to go through all this extra rigmarole, create a new stream, get the file, do the thing, get a stream reader. Because not only do you have a stream, you have to like instantiate a thing to read the stream.
Sure.
You know, do I read it one line at a time, one character at a time? Is it binary? Is it UTF-8? Then you have to clean up after all that stuff. You have to close it and dispose of it because it's iDisposable. Anyway, but turns out streams are really, really important because the naive thing is just read a file into memory and
right.
Process it. And that's almost never the right answer.
Yeah. So I'll include a couple of links into the show notes. One was, so like streams always used to sound just magical. Like they seem magical to me. I was like, oh, a stream. It was stupid because all I needed to do was read the documentation like four more times before it clicked, right? But you read it twice and you're like, ah, it doesn't make any sense. And you just kind of continue on and copy and paste some code. That was my path. That's how I learned how to program everybody. And anyway, the blog post that I'll link in the show notes about streams is maybe one of the best ones I've read. It's geared more towards Elixir itself. Like the code samples are in Elixir, but I think it does a really good job in kind of explaining how things work with diagrams and different ways you can work with streams. Like, I didn't really know that there was, I didn't know about the terms like source and sink, like the different types of streams you could have, and like what, if you want to fork a stream versus if you want to merge two streams together, like how that works. And this article goes in depth there, which is pretty, pretty nice.
Also, cool thing to note about this article, there's no images in it. Everything you see, like, it has these cool diagrams that show streams and things propagating through each kind of step in the stream. That's all CSS and HTML.
What?
Yeah, it's cool. It's really clean looking too. I love it.
What? That is really cool. I didn't look at the code before. I just assumed it was an image. This is really cool. Even cooler. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, these are great diagrams. And there's actually, have you heard of reactive programming?
Yes.
The program paradigm, right? So that's takes it to an extreme where like everything is a stream.
Yeah, I've looked at this. Like, I've heard people, you know, I've heard people talk about, what is it, RxJS. I've heard that quite a bit.
Yeah.
I looked at it briefly and I was like, okay, cool. And I closed the tab and that's about the extent of what I know about it. I think I used to have like an Egghead subscription and I watched a couple of videos on it and it just didn't click. So I didn't really pursue it any farther.
I think it's one of those things that if you buy into it and use it everywhere in your project, maybe you start to get more value out of it. But you definitely have to wrap your brain around how things go from, you know, to be more declarative in terms of, you know, steps on the stream. And like the example they give is like, you don't do variable assign. Let's say you're assigning a string to a label, right? It's, you say first, hello, first name, last name, right? Normally you would just say label dot text equals first name, last name, you know, hello, right? You concatenate the string. But whereas with reactive programming, you like, you add watchers for those first name and last name variables, kind of like in Vuex or Vue, how you have watchers, right?
Mm-hmm.
You watch those variables. Whenever those change, then you have a new step in your stream that takes the string and then emits that, and then it binds that stream or that string to like a UI element or something. And like
sure.
Everything is just piped together. It's cool to think about. I've never tried it in practice.
Yeah, I don't.
I really wanted to play with it when I was in Ruby world, but the Ruby one is not complete and not very good and not maintained. So I didn't get very far. But, and there's one for Elixir. It's called Reactive.
Really? Oh, yeah. I see that link now.
So
cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why I would need, like, what kind of thing I'd have to be working on where I would need to use a tool like this beyond what Elixir gives me out of the box.
Yeah, I'd be really interested to hear what people are doing with it successfully and why they chose that design.
Yeah, I would be interested too. I mean, to date, I've really only used streams. I mean, like the classic example for a stream is to avoid running out of RAM, right? Or running out of space, because say if you're importing 100,000 records of something and you don't use a stream, the computer has to read all 100,000 records and put that in a buffer. It just like puts it on the shelf and has to hold on to that. Whereas a stream would be more like a conveyor belt. It just kind of flows through one at a time. It's more efficient, you know? And that's really all I've used it for was, oh, well, there could be a lot of records built here. I don't want to just put those in memory.
Yeah, I had a really good application for that, for the same thing. And it's exactly, like, it was a perfect fit. And that was doing log imports for Remote Ham Radio. So by log, I mean like a log book, like a physical, you know, someone has a list of all their contacts. And like the test file I had to work with was like, I don't know, 15,000 contacts or something. It was a lot. And that was a good example because it really, really pushed the limits of what, how I could do it. And what I actually did was I broke it down into like multiple steps so we use this log format called ADIF, which is just a ham radio text-based standard. It's kind of tags-based format. It's pretty crappy, to be honest. So what I would do is start off with a file stream that just throws out chunks of binaries. And then that feeds that into a parser module, which the parser takes those strings and basically parses them, right? And turns them into little tag tuples and say, okay, says that this tag in the ADA file has this value and this data associated with it. And it just goes through linearly and just sucks up binaries and spits out tags, basically tuples. And then take the parser and go into a decoder. And for everyone who's like written a compiler or something, this is probably like, I don't know, compilers 101 or something, but I was just trying to figure it out myself, you know?
Yeah.
You go from a string to tokens, and then you go to this decoder module, which then it takes all these tags and all these, the data associated with it, and actually constructs it into structs, like contact structs in my application that are, you know, logic specific for my app. And then I would do the task async insert to actually do the database insert and try to do that, right? And that way, I could use task async stream. I could use max concurrency, you know, the default max concurrency. And I could process like 150 contacts a second or something like that. I mean, it used all my CPUs at 100%.
Right.
And it was awesome. It was awesome to churn through them in just a, you know, just a couple seconds. So that was a really, really big win. And yeah, the memory never went up. And in fact, the one thing I did get to play with was the file stream. You tell it how many bytes you want to emit. And in your head, you're like, okay, you kind of want to maybe read a large chunk of file, like a kilobyte or 2 kilobytes or I don't know, 50 kilobytes, you don't know, right? You want to read that file and process it.
Mm-hmm.
32 bytes.
Wow.
That was, I just determined that just by trial and error. 32 byte chunks gave you the most throughput. So
that's interesting.
Yeah.
You're mentioning that logbook reminds me of this app I used to use called Gyroscope, and they put out a yearly book. So Gyroscope basically just tracks a bunch of info about you, as creepy as that sounds. And at the end of the year, you can get this book that just has DataViz. It's just a DataViz book of all your stats.
Yeah, this is interesting, and it looks exactly as creepy as it sounds.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So Gyroscope, it connects to different services that you already have and imports data that way. Yes, creepy for sure. But it is pretty cool to look at. I'll put a link in the show notes. And it reminded me of this guy named Nicholas Feltron, who used to do all these data viz. So he would just take, it was much less creepy because he just did it all by hand. So he would just keep tally of like how many coffees he had and how much he slept and like all this different stuff. And at the end of the year, he'd make the annual Feltron report. And it always looked awesome. I always was like impressed like how cool all the graphs. I've always liked graphs and numbers and things like that. So it just reminds me of those two things.
Looks like a page at a USA Today.
Yeah, probably. Probably does. Or like it looks like a New York Times article.
Yeah, those are really good too.
They do some pretty cool stuff.
I've got a buddy of mine is obsessed with Last.fm. He just like he's obsessed with keeping his audio scribbles clean and visualized and, you know, has a history going back years and years and years. Every single track he's listens to in iTunes or Spotify or
224,684 scribbles.
I think you're ahead of me. You're probably ahead of me.
I listen to a lot of music, but I'll put that in the show notes if anyone wants to look at.
I'm only at 118,000.
Yeah,
scrub over here.
Well, I guess it's that time to do the outro, and by that I mean, we love feedback. I love hearing from everyone that listens to the show.
Mostly want to know about the viability of hot air balloons or any kind of inflatable balloon in the event of a major catastrophic event.
I mean, I don't see short of a hailstorm, short of an act of God, I don't see how it could be any worse. I mean, just bring a lot of fishing line. You can float up over the water and you can catch some dinner. You've already got the fire up there to cook dinner. You know what I mean? You could have that charbroiled fish.
I think what you have here is an idea for a new survival game.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Kickstarter. Coming soon.
Hot air balloon. It's like Battle Royale, but you're in hot air balloons. Picture this. You're in hot air balloon. It's a Battle Royale. That's all you have to picture.
One hot air balloon or everyone has their own?
It's Fortnite Season 8. That's what it is.
Pretty small map.
Yeah.
It's only a wicker basket. Tell Sean how terrible his idea is at Sean Washbutt on Twitter, at DNC Show. For show-related things, which at this point, who knows anymore?
Yeah.
I'm Shrockwell on Twitter.
And as always, show notes are available at dnc.show. And I put everything that we talked about there today, some screenshots, some other things, some goodies in there. So if you're interested in any of the links that we talked about, head on over to dnc.show and you'll find them there.
We'll also post the show notes over at spectrum.chat, where we've got a channel for the show, as well as all kinds of other podcasts and design and development related things. I got a new mic here this week. You may have noticed. You may not have noticed. Curious to see how you guys think it sounds. I'm curious myself, to be honest.
That's a very formal request to at him. So I know in the past he said don't at him, but I think now he just said at me. So
yeah, do at me.
Do at him about his microphone. As always, thanks to Spec for having us. And if you're into other design and development related podcasts, you should definitely head on over to spec.fm and check some of those out. You might be interested in Fragmented if you're interested in learning about Android development and you like Java. Or Kotlin, I suppose. I don't know. I hear that's pretty cool. If you're into Swift, we've got Swift Unwrapped. And if you're into design, there's Design Details, which are just some really good conversations about design. I've learned a lot about design from them. So yeah, go to spec.fm to check those out.
This week's episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson.
Well, I think I need to get to work on some of this conceptual art for Fortnite Season 8.
I'll be waiting. I'll be critiquing.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
See ya. Thanks again to Manifold for being a sponsor of Does Not Compute. Make sure to go to manifold.co/DNC to get your $10 credit towards any service on the Manifold Marketplace. Yeah, we went a little off the rails there.